Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle and the Insider's insight into today's most pressing issues. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, it's been 50 years since the Cuban Missile Crisis. What really happened? We'll explore that through the newly declassified documents. Then, Liz Winstead on the birth of The Daily Show, the death of Air America, and the state of media and comedy today. The United Nations General Assembly has once more voted to condemn the United States' policies towards Cuba. It was the 21st time that the body has taken such a vote. But this vote comes just after the 50-year anniversary of the Cuban Missile Crisis, a pivotal moment in history. As more documents are becoming declassified, the history of the Cuban Missile Crisis is becoming clearer. What really happened during the Cuban Missile Crisis, and what can we learn about American foreign policy, past and present? We're joined by Peter Kornbluh. He directs the Cuba Documentation Project and the Chile Documentation Project at the National Security Archive. He's the author of numerous books, including The Iran-Contra Scandal, The Declassified History, and The Pinochet File, a declassified dossier on atrocity and accountability. Welcome, Peter Kornbluh.
Thank you, Maria.
We just saw this vote from the United Nations General Assembly, again condemning the United States' treatment of Cuba. It's something like the 21st time. Is there anything new?
Well, there's nothing new in the vote itself, but the vote is a symbolic reminder that the rest of the world thinks, as John F. Kennedy once acknowledged, that we are demented on our Cuba policy. 21 straight years, the United Nations has overwhelmingly voted. The world community has overwhelmingly spoken out against the U.S. embargo in Cuba, and it reminds all of us of how isolated the United States is. The vote was 188 countries to three, one of them being us, one of them being Palau, which has about 21,000 inhabitants, and one of them being Israel, which votes with the United States politically at the U.N., but then goes and invests heavily in agriculture in Cuba. And has a number of corporate businesses there. So it's really an amazing kind of international statement, and hopefully it's one that President Obama, as a second-term Democrat, no longer beholden to Florida anti-Castro exiles, might finally hear.
How powerful is the Cuban lobby from Florida now? Is it that big that it can have that much influence over a foreign policy issue like this?
Well, one of the great things about the election last week, Maria, is that Florida wasn't even a factor. President Obama was declared president with the vote not even fully counted in Florida, and that's the first time that that has happened in recent memory. Florida has traditionally been a swing state. It certainly was a state that Obama had his eye on the entire time he was in office. Those handful of Cuban-American votes that could become the difference between him being president, being reelected, or not being reelected, as we saw in the case of the Bush and Gore election in November of 2000, really were votes that they looked at, and they did not want to jeopardize the potential of having those votes by really changing Cuba policy. Now Obama's a second-term Democrat. Florida was not in play. He won far more Cuban-American votes than any other candidate of the Democratic Party has in the past. So at least from domestic policy point of view, he is freed from kind of the Florida albatross that has really been a factor in policymaking on Cuba for presidents in the past.
And before we move on into the anniversary of the Cuban Missile Crisis, why is it that the Cuban-American community in Florida still wants this in place?
Well, I should say that not all the Cuban-American community still wants this in place. The polls are increasingly showing that a small majority of Cuban-Americans in Florida would like to see the travel ban completely lifted. They themselves, I think, voted more for Obama because he lifted the travel ban for them. Cuban-Americans can freely travel back and forth to Cuba now, and they can send unlimited amounts of remittances to their relatives. But the rest of us, you and me, the average American citizens, can't freely travel to Cuba. The polls in the polling data from Florida show that the Cuban-American community has started to really change. It's no longer monolithic on being anti-Castro. It's no longer monolithic on being hardcore against lifting the embargo. It's about 50-50 now. But really, that's not the issue. The issue is that the embargo should be lifted because it's in the U.S. interest to lift it. It's in U.S. political interest, national security interest, and economic interest to have better relations with Cuba. And if the goal is to bring democracy to Cuba, well, you know, that's more likely to happen if we don't have a national security threat, don't present a national security threat to Cuba as we have these last 50 years, and just have normal relations.
So now let's put this into more of a historic context, because last month we had the anniversary of the Cuban Missile Crisis, a very significant one. As the documents have become unclassified, you've been writing the history as it is becoming clearer, and we've got quite a few lessons from the Cuban Missile Crisis. Let's compare the official story to now what we're learning actually happened. What are these differences?
Well, the Cuban Missile Crisis is a stark reminder that when we are antagonistic and threatening to a smaller country like Cuba, that country will take steps to defend itself. It won't just roll over and play dead, as so many U.S. policymakers expected of Fidel Castro. After John F. Kennedy authorized the Bay of Pigs invasion in April of 1961, and then after that failure authorized the massive kind of set of covert operations known as Operation Mongoose, the Cubans went to the Soviet Union, signed a military defense treaty, and under that treaty eventually accepted the Soviet proposal to have nuclear intermediate-range ballistic missiles on the island as a deterrent to any further U.S. Open aggression. And, of course, the discovery of those missiles being put in place in Cuba in October of 1962, 50 years ago, created the missile crisis, as it's called, and led to what was clearly the most dangerous days not only of the Cold War, but of all of mankind. Really the moment when the superpowers came closest to firing these atomic weapons, when the world came closest to the doomsday scenario. So it's really a very important event, and it has lessons for U.S.-Cuban relations. It has lessons for conflict with Iran right now. We have spent, at my office, the National Security Archive, more than 25 years trying to get every single page of documents, not only from the United States, but from the former Soviet Union, from Cuba itself, out, analyzed, and understood for the lessons that the missile crisis holds.
It's been 50 years. Why is it there are still some documents that haven't been released?
You know, there are a lot of intelligence sources and methods that include the way the CIA and the National Security Agency track submarines underwater and ships above water and that kind of thing, that even 50 years later they still feel they have to protect. There are documents in the Soviet Union from the former Soviet Union that are still coming out. A colleague of mine, Svetlana Savranskaya, just released 2 weeks ago a new book of Russian documents on the missile crisis that are very revealing. And the Cubans themselves have declassified some documents for these international conferences that we have been involved in organizing, but certainly they have many more archives that the world, I think, would benefit from seeing. Some colleagues and I are going to Cuba in just a couple of weeks to hold yet another set of conferences on the missile crisis, and we'll be discussing, you know, what further information is available there.
You mentioned the CIA. I was struck by a few things that you documented. One was that President Kennedy defied the CIA and used a secret go-between instead of going with their strategy. The second thing I was very struck by was the president of a company got a message from Khrushchev himself that indicated Khrushchev didn't want to go to any kind of extremes. So we have these two powerful leaders. Neither of them really want to go forward in terms of an aggressive campaign.
We have to say, be clear, that both Kennedy and Khrushchev got us into this crisis. Kennedy, by pursuing an aggressive and almost baldly interventionist set of policies towards Cuba, and Khrushchev by somewhat recklessly thinking that he could secretly put these missiles into into Cuba, get away with that operation, and then kind of declare a fait accompli that Kennedy would just have to accept. And, you know, both of them, ironically, had discussed at the Vienna summit just a year before, after the Bay of Pigs invasion, that Cuba could become a place in which the superpowers confronted each other. And Khrushchev had very forcefully warned Kennedy that that was the case. And here it actually ended up happening. And once they were both in what General Curtis LeMay, one of the hardline generals who was in charge of 3,000 nuclear missiles in the United States and who actually wanted to, you know, go to war with the Soviets over Cuba, what he called a pickle. Once that Khrushchev and Kennedy got into the, as LeMay put it, a pickle over this, over the missiles being put in Cuba, they really both wanted to get out of it without anybody firing a shot. And the missile crisis mythology is that the United States took a very forceful stand, put a quarantine around Cuba, had its naval ships out there. Kennedy threatened war and big massive buildup to invade Cuba, and the Soviets kind of blinked and retreated. There was a famous iconic statement by Secretary of State Dean Rusk, we were eyeball to eyeball, and I think the other guy just blinked. And the idea was that the Soviets had blinked and backed down. The secret history of the missile crisis is that, in fact, Kennedy gave Khrushchev something he wanted. Publicly, he agreed to not invade Cuba in the aftermath of the crisis, but privately, Kennedy had his brother tell the Soviet leader that we would secretly agree to withdraw our missiles in Turkey, U.S. missiles pointed at the Soviet Union that were based in Turkey, if the Soviets withdrew their missiles in Cuba. And 5 or 6 months after the missile crisis abated, the United States did start to dismantle those missiles, but the Kennedy clan and advisors kept this kind of resolution a secret for almost decades later. Almost 30 years went by before the full kind of documentation on that swap, on that quid pro quo, was fully known. And the lessons of the crisis were not learned. The lessons that were taken away by people like Lyndon Johnson and others who weren't told of this secret swap was that, you know, might makes right, and the use of force can force your opponent to back down. Kind of the muscular U.S. foreign policy, when in fact the missile crisis was an example in the end of a great commitment to diplomacy, creative diplomacy, secret diplomacy, back-channel diplomacy that saved the world in the end.
Let me just remind listeners that we're speaking with Peter Kornbluh. He directs the Cuba Documentation Project and the Chile Documentation Project at the National Security Archive. It was interesting that you led off in this article that Republicans have used it as almost the opposite.
Yeah, you know, 10 years ago, I took the late Arthur Schlesinger, Robert McNamara, and Theodore Sorensen to Cuba to meet with Fidel Castro and the Soviet generals on the 40th anniversary of the missile crisis. And George W. Bush was getting ready to invade Iraq, and he kind of appropriated Kennedy's words from the missile crisis to tell the American people that the Cuban Missile Crisis was an example of a kind of preemptive strike. And all three of Kennedy's top advisors who were still alive then spoke out in Cuba and told the press that, in fact, Bush was misrepresenting history, that Kennedy had worked very hard to avoid a preemptive strike, fearing that such a strike on Cuba and the missiles there would set off kind of a cycle of violence, a cycle of superpower confrontation that might end with the Soviets invading Berlin and somebody firing a missile, and then all the missiles being fired. And so he had worked very hard to avoid attacking Cuba, firing on Soviet installations, etc. And Arthur Schlesinger told the press that if Bush had been his student, he would have flunked him in history. And now we see, even today, Benjamin Netanyahu kind of referring to the missile crisis as a reason to draw a red line in the sand with Iran. So the missile crisis is being used as a way to kind of bolster the argument that force is necessary, when it really is a lesson in the use of diplomacy and the commitment of a president who overruled all of his aides, by the way, to make this secret deal with the Soviet Union. It's a lesson of how a president remains committed to some type of creative diplomacy to avoid the threat of nuclear war.
There were a couple of people you mentioned in that article. One was William Knox, who was president of Westinghouse, and another was a journalist, John Scali. What were their roles in this?
William Knox, the CEO of Westinghouse, just happened to be visiting the Soviet Union. Of course, Westinghouse was interested in detente and investment employments in Russia. And he was there. He found himself in Moscow, sitting in front of Khrushchev just less than 48 hours after Kennedy announced to the world on October 22nd that the U.S. had found these missiles and that Khrushchev better get them out, and that we were instituting a naval quarantine in order to give him time to reconsider his position on the missiles. And Khrushchev used Knox as kind of the first intermediary. He was pretty forceful, though. He said, look, I put those missiles in Cuba for defensive reasons, to keep you from invading Cuba again. If you invade Cuba now, he said, you'll find that your Guantanamo base will be destroyed the very first day. He didn't let on what this was a hint about, which was that the Soviets had positioned battlefield nuclear cruise missiles on a ridge right above the Guantanamo base and planned to fire them on the base if the United States invaded Cuba and planned to use that base as a kind of a staging ground for the invasion. And Khrushchev said to Knox, you know, I don't want us to go towards the destruction of the world, but if you really want to meet in hell, you know, let's do it. I mean, it was kind of bluster, but still caution. And so that message came back to the United States pretty quickly. John Scali was an ABC News reporter. One of his sources was the leading KGB officer working in the Soviet embassy here in Washington, where I am. And the two of them met at a Chinese restaurant and discussed what possible resolutions to the crisis there might be. And that was the first time the United States got word from a Soviet official that maybe Khrushchev would withdraw the missiles if the United States simply pledged not to invade Cuba. It turned out that the KGB officer was actually trying to gather intelligence on what possible, you know, resolutions the United States would consider by kind of floating this idea. And he wasn't sent by Khrushchev to offer this, but he was kind of feeling out the United States. But this became the beginning of kind of a hope that there could be some kind of resolution. And as I say, that became the public side of how the crisis was resolved. And then there was a very deep secret private side as well.
Why is it that Kennedy and his advisors created this kind of myth right after?
Well, they believed, the Kennedy brothers, John and Robert, believed that Kennedy would be too vulnerable politically if he kind of swapped the missiles, that his enemies in Congress, the Republicans, and even many Southern Democrats would accuse him of yielding to nuclear blackmail, of giving the Soviets too much. You can hear Kennedy on his secret tapes talking about how it was easy to reject the proposal now, but it would look as such a great proposal a week later after the United States had invaded Cuba and the blood had flown in Cuba and perhaps the Soviets had then grabbed Berlin and the United States was faced with what to do then and tens of thousands of people were dead. And somebody would say, gee, if you just swapped those old missiles in Turkey for the missiles in Cuba, we would have avoided all this. And he actually thinks out loud in this meeting on October 27th down the road. And he's literally the only one in the room who's willing to go this route. And what we've learned in the last 20 years or so about this is that, one, he clearly dispatched his brother to make this private offering to Khrushchev. Two, he had a plan B. He was concerned that Khrushchev might not accept this informal secret pledge, that he wouldn't trust Kennedy enough to actually say, oh, yes, the United States will do this if I pull out those missiles, and he goes ahead and pulls out the missiles. So Kennedy had a plan B. He dispatched a secret message to the United Nations and to the head of the United Nations, the Secretary General, U Thant, where he basically said, look, we may need you to propose from the United Nations this trade of the missiles in Turkey and in Cuba. I can't propose it myself for political reasons, but you could propose it, and I pledge to you in this secret message that I will accept it, and then the pressure would be on Khrushchev to accept it as well. So he was really willing to go the extra mile to avoid attacking Cuba and unleashing the Pandora's box of violence in the shadow of a nuclear bomb. And one of the things in the Cigar Aficionado article, which is on the stands right now for anybody who wants to read it, is that Kennedy also authorized an approach to Fidel Castro through the Brazilian government of João Goulart, offering to accept the Cuban Revolution kind of back into the Western domain if Castro kicked out the Soviets and their missiles. The message got there a day after the Soviets agreed to withdraw the missiles, so it became somewhat of a moot point, but in some ways it set a stage for secret talks that went on right up until the moment that John Kennedy was killed, efforts between Cuba and the United States to come to some kind of rapprochement. And that history is important. It's important for Barack Obama to know today. He, too, should be seeking a rapprochement with Cuba so that we make sure that hostility never leads to this kind of danger again.
That's the perfect place to end. Thank you so much, Peter Kornbluh.
You're more than welcome, Maria. Thank you.
Stay tuned.
Wishing away at you, girl. I'm wishing and wishing away at you, girl. I don't see nothing but pain and misery, 'cause you are the one for me. Why can't it all be true? Can I escape with my blue falling? Can it all be true? Why can it all be true?
You are listening to the Scholar Circle and the Insiders, Insight into Today's Most Pressing Issues, and I'm Maria Armudian. Liz Winstead joins us now. She is the co-creator and the former head writer of The Daily Show and one of the founders of Air America Radio. Her book is called Liz Free or Die. First, let me welcome you, Liz Winstead.
Thank you.
Great to have you here. Liz Free or Die, your essays, it's autobiographical in a way. Memoirs?
It's definitely autobiographical, and it's memoir-ish. I didn't focus on one particular period of my life and tell that story. I kind of hit on touchstone moments and skipped over some things. But just to get you kind of understanding what the life of a young girl in the 1960s with bizarro role models, how she found this crazy voice and how that voice became comedy and how that comedy became political.
And how that comedy that became political actually had an important impact. In fact, I thought since we're a political show, we should start kind of in the middle with The Daily Show.
Sure.
And how it came to be. I thought one of the very interesting parts about your memoir was how you'd actually been thinking about doing something like this and it sort of developed.
Yeah. To talk about how The Daily Show came to be, you have to go back a little bit in time and how I actually became obsessed with how the media and politics all started melding. And for me, I grew up in Minnesota, and it was funny because I grew up with really conservative parents in the middle of what my dad called the People's Republic of Minnesota. every year he would go to the Minnesota State Fair and bitch about Hubert Humphrey until he died in 2006. It was insane.
And he made a great comedian later.
He did, indeed. So it was the night of the first Gulf War, and I was on a blind date. Remember those? Before internet dating, there was blind dates. And I had, you know, politics, and my comedy act was not particularly political at this point. This was back early 90s. I'd talk about feminism a little bit, how women were portrayed in the media, but I didn't really go anywhere in particular. And so I had a blind date the night of the first Gulf War. I didn't know it was going to be the night of the first Gulf War. But I'm on my blind date. We go see La Dolce Vita. The guy was a dork. He hated it and actually said, it was black and white. Like, that was awful.
It
didn't go so well, but I'm from Minnesota and you're nice to people. So after the date, I was like, well, do you want to go have a drink? And so he goes, yeah, let's go to the bar I always watch some sporting event at. And so we walk in and there was a huge TV and it wasn't sports on. It was the war had started and everyone at the bar was staring at the TV and it was CNN. It was back when CNN was the only 24-hour news channel at the time. And everyone was staring, and I started watching it, and it had that green light, and the bombs were dropping, and it sort of looked like fireworks. And then all these anchors were really hot, and they were reporting from roofs and hotel rooms, and it was all very orchestrated, and there was a theme song and graphics. And I thought to myself, are they reporting on a war, or are they trying to sell me a war? And right as that notion just crossed my head, my doofy blind date goes, this is so cool. And my heart sank. And at that moment, I thought, how many Americans are watching it going, this is so cool, and not realizing we're at war. This isn't a game. I never understood what it meant to have a calling before that night. But then my mind started to race. And I thought, how many other things do the media tell us that we just buy? How many other press releases from the White House do they just report on? How much of this is just pretty people telling America? And I just started going crazy, and I just started watching obsessively and reading all different kinds of media that I could get my hands on, and then comparing how what I would read in The Nation or Mother Jones or Harper's would be different from what was being reported to people via the broadcast news. And my whole act started changing. I started writing that way, and I started going on the road, and there was fits and starts. And most of the time people hated it, but I kind of didn't care because it just poured out of me. And finally, I had started developing a following just by weeding out the people who hated what I said and bringing in people who liked it. And I got a job on the Jon Stewart Show. He had a show before The Daily Show called The Jon Stewart Show, producing guest segments. And it was a wonderful experience, but it was a short-lived experience. I was only there for about 9 months and the show got canceled. And my bosses from there got the job heading up Comedy Central. And so they had been paying attention to my comedy trajectory. And the first thing they wanted to do was a show that was on every day. And so they called the woman who was the executive producer of John's show and me in and said, do you guys want to do a show? And I said, oh my God, I've been for the past 4 years screaming at anybody who will listen about how this is, we are in this weird trajectory with the media. I said, I'd love to. I said, but the one thing that I would suggest is that we make the show a character, that we say, it's not just about the people in the news, it's about the news too. And we have a real opportunity to look and sound like a newsroom, but act like a comedy show. And it was the first time that it really ever been done before, because with Weekend Update or even That Was the Week That Was or Laugh-In, any shows that had some kind of social criticism didn't take on the meat of how media was. And I think that maybe because it was so standard back then, when it started to glamorize itself, you know, when you could watch CNN with the sound turned down and you could be watching at the TV, not hearing anything that was going on, but see a playground shot with a single swing, black and white, and that swing just swinging back and forth, and you knew that they were talking about child abduction. You just knew. You know, you could bleep out anybody saying anything and it sounds like they're swearing or saying something awful. You know, the way that things got so manipulated and the way we were so emotionally manipulated in the news was really exciting to me. And so we developed this crazy show. We decided to call it The Daily Show because it was on every day and that seemed real creative. And we were off to the races.
There were so many interesting facets of this. You describe how you started sending reporters out. You started being a reporter on this as well. to attend the same events
yeah.
that the regular reporters were attending, but asking questions to almost challenge how they'd been reporting.
That's exactly right. And we would get into the gaggle when we launched the show. Mike McCurry was the spokesperson for Clinton. And we would ask the same questions, but they were skewed. And we looked like them, but we were asking questions like, I don't even remember what we asked.
I can remember okay. a couple of just things that made me laugh. One was Reverend Jesse Jackson.
Oh, yes. Well, that was crazy. That was the first interview I did. I ran up to Jesse Jackson, as reporters do, and I said, Reverend Jackson, do you have time to answer a question from The Daily Show? And he said, yes, I do. And I was like, you do? And then I just stopped. And that was all we got from Jesse Jackson, because I completely froze at the thought that Jesse Jackson was going to talk to me. Like, I could not believe it. That made me laugh. Or just, we would like, oh, is this where you spin? Mike McCurry? And he goes, well, I don't think we call it spinning. And so A. Whitney Brown took him and just kept spinning him around to the point where he was completely dizzy and said, now can we call it spinning? You don't seem to want to call it spinning, yet that's all you do. So if we physically make you spin, then we will have you actually admit that you were spinning. So it was really fun, and it just kicked off a whole new way that people got their information through calling the bull on the media as well as the media makers, which is really great because it gives people an opportunity to question the information they're given, not just take it at face value. And I think that's when satire is at its best. It makes you want to learn more and want to know more, and it makes you a skeptic, which is healthy for everybody.
Let me just remind listeners that we're speaking with Liz Winstead, and she's got her new memoir out called Liz Free or Die Essays. Now, back to this process of building The Daily Show, because you were on the ground floor of it.
Yeah.
You had this moment where you brought in Stephen Colbert.
Yes.
How did that happen?
Well, the show was growing sort of fast and furious. It grew quickly, immediately. It caught on with people very fast, and we needed more correspondents. We needed to send people out in the field. And the challenge of the show was finding people who were news savvy, had historical knowledge, were funny, and then could, if they were performers, could sort of put their persona, if they had developed a strong one, aside to work within the confines of being this news team, because that was the key to it, is to really stay in character, don't break, and so that when you are saying things that are outrageous, you're mirroring the outrage that's happening in the real media. So any nod or wink takes you out of, you know, the real strength of what was going on. And so I had known Stephen because he was really funny on a show called Exit 57, and he was on Strangers with Candy, and he was this great comedic actor, but it had never occurred to me that he would be good on The Daily Show. And then I saw him doing pieces on Good Morning America, and I was like, there's something behind those eyes. Like, he's not really all in on this kind of, I'm the wacky guy in the morning thing. And I thought, he's really great. And so I said, everybody watch Good Morning America. Stephen Colbert's on, he's funny. And when everybody saw him, it was just like, get him on board immediately. He's great.
You left as Jon Stewart came back
in. Yes.
Why would you leave at that point? You'd worked together before.
I left. There's sort of varying things of why I left. I don't really talk about why I left. I left.
Okay.
There was a little bit of a controversy and blah, blah, blah. I left mostly because when you have a show that's on that you see making an impact, you want to put more stuff on the airwaves. And you hope that you can find little pockets to take over some of the crowd that was going on. Because the one thing I think that people forget is when The Daily Show launched, it was a slightly different show because we had a slightly different media. It was at the time when If It Bleeds, It Leads was all the rage. There was 5,000 sort of Maury, Jerry, you know, Montel chat shows that just polluted daytime. And then the evening was all those news magazine shows that scared the living crap out of everyone. You know, it was like, if your mattress, what you don't know might kill you. You know, everything that you didn't know might kill you. And the local news was child abduction. Everything was just heightened to this fear level, creating fear where it didn't exist. And so we came in doing that and followed that lead. And The Daily Show, after I left, what's so brilliant is the one thing I had hoped when I left was that they just followed the trends of the news and kept mirroring that. And they did it brilliantly. And John and the team do it great. But for me, what was interesting was I thought, because The Daily Show was two things that were very handsome, I would think, to a programmer. It costs 5 cents. And it generates a lot of press because you're talking about things every day. What we found out, which is the saddest part of all, is the downfall is that it has no shelf life. So what's everybody wants is syndicated shows. How can this live? Can this live forever? We can watch Seinfeld now still because the episodes don't die. And so it was harder and harder to get a show that responded to the world on the air because they couldn't repurpose it over and over again and keep making money off of it.
So then you left there and you tried to create another show, but that was post 9/11. Is that right?
Yeah.
And everything had changed at that point.
That's right. After 9/11, trying to get any kind of show that would challenge the government or the media was just completely frowned upon. Don't pitch it. We're all in it. Everything was any hint of maybe we should examine why any of this is going on was greeted with some sort of lack of patriotism. You were a traitor. And it was like, are you people kidding? You really just want to let this go and not explore anything at all? Like, there's nothing that we can look at in American society and the way our world works and our elections that were decided by the Supreme Court. We see no humor in this. We are all really... So
I always find it interesting, too, that you're not patriotic if you want to improve your country.
I know. And what's so fascinating about that is that mindset doesn't work. It's ridiculous. But it doesn't work in any other facet of life. You couldn't pull that in your marriage or your job to say, hey, let's just keep this really crappy job going where we really don't sell anything
and
it's
no
not
humor.
Working and have no humor and nobody wants to buy our product. We're just going to go with the status quo and try to figure out why, never to ask why people hate our product internationally, why no one buys it, why they're mad at us. Let's not explore that or your husband or anything. But yet with this patriotism business, I don't know why you wouldn't want a better country and to look at it because, well, I think we all know why. But when your president says, go buy things, that's the patriotic thing to do. That sort of in one sentence encapsulates exactly why we need many, 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 many comedy shows to examine why we have a president that says to the American people, just go buy things, and why that's a really good answer.
But you did finally get another show going.
We did. We got another show going. And sort of the trifecta of when you have a Colbert show, which, you know, takes on that sort of O'Reilly genre, The Daily Show, which takes on cable and whatever, the morning shows hadn't been tapped into. And so Brian Unger, who was one of the original correspondents on The Daily Show, and I decided we wanted to tackle morning news. And it was very interesting as we were doing our research that the bulk of the budgets of news programming goes to morning shows, which I did not know. Mm-hmm. And so when you're watching, you know, now I think the Today Show is it just all day? Is it? I think it might be 18 hours, the Today Show. I'm not sure, but it's very long. And so knowing that money that could be going to investigative journalism is going to Kathy Lee saying, you know, does this belt make my butt look fat? And we're going to do 3.5 minutes on that. That was just prime fodder. And so we went into it and really took on the corporatist look at news programming, product placement, you know, any
your
kind
own
of
magazine.
Oh, yes. We had our own magazines. You
now,
know.
Were you making fun of Oprah with that?
We were making fun of Oprah because once Oprah had a magazine, then everybody had a magazine. Rosie had a magazine, everybody had a magazine. Yes, all of it. And the narcissism that went along with it. And we decided to look at how people are just perfectly fine with having the outback back alley concert series, or, you know, they don't even, and how they would just, everything is sponsored. And the only stories that you tell are sponsored by Wendy's or some other thing. And so
Colbert is doing that now.
Yes. Yeah. And so that was really, really fun. And the New York Times gave it this huge review and it was going really great. We did 6 episodes and then we were promptly canceled because it was on Oxygen, the network for women, which we thought, how fun of you to actually take on a little bit of yourself. And they just thought, we don't even want ratings. And they actually said, and I'll never forget, this is not the direction we want the network to go in. We're going to develop shows that involve women with weapons, which I, it was like when you let the air out of the Macy's balloon, I just like went, and I didn't even say, what's women's with weapons? I didn't want to know.
Now, what year was that?
That was in 2003.
So it was really not that much longer.
No.
Not after 9/11.
2002, actually. Yeah, it was from 2002 to 2003. No, it was right after it. And we took on some kind of big ticket items. We took on the Taliban and how women in Afghanistan were.
I thought that was amusing. Tell our listeners about that.
Well, you know, it was very interesting how one of the first things that came out of the invasion of Afghanistan was that we were really liberating the women. And that was the propagandist news that was coming back. And it was like, oh, we are? That's interesting. And so we decided to do a send up of the way that Americans liberated the women of Afghanistan was making designer burqas. And we had a Burberry burqa and a beach burqa that was made of terry cloth and just getting it completely wrong about what it meant to be liberated and what morning show talk shows would think liberated would be is to wear a cute burqa. You know what? This is cute. It's very stylish, a lot of plaid, it's fun. And missing the point entirely, which I think happens a lot on those morning shows.
Let me just remind listeners that we're speaking with Liz Winstead, and she's got her new memoir out called Liz Free or Die Essays. So then you ended up getting called to develop a new radio network.
Yes. I had come off a horrible stint doing, in the height of the don't bring your judge and the government round here sort of television landscape. I had done a spring break show for MTV with which every feminist card I've ever had, I think, was revoked. And I think I don't think there's enough showers went to take after you've gone to MTV. And I remember it was just what you would imagine. And I write about actually what the show was in the book, and I won't get into it here. But imagine me in the MTV offices printing out Colin Powell's speech before the United Nations, lying to the world about weapons of mass destruction, and me reading that on a plane, going down to shoot a show that involved scantily clothed women and college co-eds. It was crazy. I knew that I was the only person in the building on that day that was actually going to be doing both of those things simultaneously. So I had shot that pilot. I said, I will not work on this if it goes to a series. It was way too reprehensible. And I was sitting in my apartment in L.A., literally saying, I don't know what's going to happen to me next. And I got a call from this man named John Sinton. And he said, hi, my name is John Sinton, and I'm calling because we're launching a progressive radio network in New York. And Al Franken gave me your phone number, and we're looking for a Liz Winstead type. And I was like, is my reputation bad that somebody wants a Liz Winstead kinda? Or is it that just another, you know, scam where they act like they want to do something progressive and they use the word progressive, but really it's not progressive at all. It's just some, you know, lame-o thing. And then he went on and talked about how, you know, the talk radio landscape was 94% conservative to 6% even moderate or Democrat, or forget about progressive. It was like Pacifica, and that was it. And so it was just this big behemoth thing, and we wanted to changed the way things worked, and we wanted to combine comedy and politics and speak truth to power, and we weren't a voice for, you know, we weren't like the hub of the Democratic Party. We got to have our own opinions, and I was like, this can't really be happening. I'm really getting this call, and it really happened, and I went back to New York and with a job of programming director, one of the programming directors, and spent a good amount of time trying to get this thing off the ground in crazy time. And I was going to have the 9 to noon slot on the radio. And I was so busy trying to program everybody else that I did not have a co-host. Then Chuck D signed on from Public Enemy, who is this amazing progressive. And he was my co-host. And I was like, oh my God, I'm kind of freaking out that I'm going to be on the radio with Chuck D, but I can't even process that because we have to have another co-host who's really this big brain journalist. And we weren't finding the right person, and we were getting inundated with horrible submissions, and our bosses were sort of, some were progressive and then some were radio people who didn't really know about progressive politics, so they were throwing people at me that, like, Jerry Springer was thrown at me, you know, well, he's a liberal. I'm like, yeah, really? I'm glad that he votes for Democrats, but he makes millions of dollars exploiting people on television every day. So as long as I'm taking a paycheck here, I will not do a show with Jerry Springer, and he will not be on our network. Gloria Allred, I'm like, ugh, no. Again, no. And so we were like going to launch in a month and a half, and we still didn't have this third person. And I got a call from an old friend of mine who had moved to Western Massachusetts about 3 years before. And he was one in a litany of people who had a programming person that he knew who was great. And when you get a job where you can hire people, everybody's got a friend who's really good at something. And you're just like, oh, I'm sure your friend is really good, but I've just listened to like 300 demo reels of somebody's friend, and everybody's friend isn't good so far. So I said, all right, send me your friend from Western Massachusetts who's really awesome. Send it. Yes, I'm sure she's great. And he goes, well, you really listen to it, because she sent three things and nobody's ever called her back. And they ended up someplace. And I'm like, I promise I will send
it
to my
home. Was that Rachel Maddow?
And that was Rachel Maddow. Yeah. And that was Rachel Maddow. And so I listened to it and I was like, wow, she's awesome. And so I called, you know, and I said, can you come down and meet with us? And she said, I'll get on a bus in 15 minutes. So she took the Peter Pan bus down from Western Mass and met with us. And we talked about politics and booze and dogs. And, you know, she had done a lot of work with AIDS in prison. And, you know, she was just this brilliant, brilliant woman who was perfect. And
you really launched her career.
Well, I gave her a platform and she launched her career. You know, she was a joy to work with. She was just smart and dedicated and curious and had the same drive that I did. And so it was great to be able to do a show with Chuck D and Rachel. And Chuck always called us the three-headed Hydra, because we all admired what they each did. And we didn't have any jealousy about, oh, I wish I was more Chuck, or I wish I was more Rachel. We all had our roles, and Rachel gave us kind of our marching orders, and we investigated on our own then from that, and I would provide humor, and Chuck would provide this incredible international perspective because of his like global touring, and the way he sees the world was so incredible, where we could talk about an issue and he'd be like, you want to know what they're saying about us, you know, over here? And it was so great, and we just had this great team, and it was amazing, and it was great. And then one day the network started financially falling apart because the guys that started it were kind of like a Vanity Fair article come to life, lied about the money, kind of crazy grifters. It was nuts. They went away. They hired this new guy to come in who decided that humor wasn't a good tool for social change. And so he got rid of me and moved Rachel to 5 o'clock in the morning, got rid of all the comedy writers, got rid of Mark Maron, and put Jerry Springer on in place of our show. And it was like, I don't even know what to say.
And the rest of that is history.
And the rest of that is history. But, you know, what I always say to people is when they kind of, they want to know about the crumbling and the falling of Air America, and I talk about it to a degree in the book, but I really talk about the fact that when it was spiraling financially out of control, the people who got the biggest paychecks were paying for their staffs to get paid. We tried to cover people's health insurance on our own. We did whatever we could, and none of the talent quit. Even when we weren't getting paid, everybody stayed because the product superseded all the bad management and all the crap, and it was really important to make sure that this voice lived. So it was kind of cool to watch the camaraderie of those people come through, and that's what made it great.
Let me just remind listeners that we're speaking with Liz Winstead, and she's got her new memoir out called Liz Free or Die Essays. Having gone through that now and looking at American politics today and being a comedian, I think there's two questions in this. Let me bifurcate them. I think the first one is, suppose you were describing American politics to somebody who knew nothing about it. How would you describe American politics now?
I would say American politics today seems nothing more than figuring out a way to globalize the world with American corporate interests. In a nutshell, that's what I would say. I'm quite tired of, it seems like we keep moving farther and farther to the right in social issues, in the money in politics now. It, you know, I never thought it would get worse, and then Citizens United happened, and boy, didn't that change everything. But, you know, both political parties are in bed with money, money, money. And it's like, I don't know what a progressive politician really is anymore. Everything's moved so far to the right that you keep hearkening back and going, wow, remember Nixon? He started the EPA. Wasn't that crazy?
And remember the war on poverty.
Yeah, you know, the war on poverty. And if Watergate wouldn't have happened, we might have had universal health care. Like, he was literally introducing that to the world. And so, you know, when you hearken back to the Barry Goldwater and people who were just horrible as people who were of reason, it's a frightening state of affairs. It's a frightening state of affairs when science is disregarded. And if you're a person running for the highest office in the land and you talk about climate change or science, you're drummed out of a political party. Yet if you're a biblical literalist, a piece of, you know, arguable literature, and you use that to formulate your political policies, you can be leader of the free world.
And the mass media, you started out as a media critic.
Yeah.
What about today?
Today, we have a whole lot of people wondering aloud on television who are not journalists. They're spokesbots, almost. They're personalities with opinions who are, I yell a lot at the television, because my job as a social satirist is twofold. I have to read things and listen to things that I think make me smarter, that I've trusted at news sources. Then I have to watch television news to see how America gets their information, so I can try to figure out, and I don't want to blame them for the information they're getting. We live in a really busy world where things are really hard, and if you're going to take a half an hour out of your day to get some information about what happened, where do you do that? In fact, I just saw a clip from The Simpsons. They're doing a voter ID thing that's coming out where Homer Simpson says, I'm a 40-year-old white guy and I get all my information from the TV monitor at the gas station. And it's like, yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. That is one way to get information. And so when I know more as a comedian than people hosting Sunday morning shows, when they don't have follow-up questions and they sound surprised at certain things. And when we have elected officials now, when you look at the Todd Akin debacle, when we have somebody who's elected to Congress six times who believes that women have magical juices that kill rape sperm. You know, this isn't fringy crap. These are people who are elected over and over and over again. So when our news media is surprised they exist, that is the part that frightens me more than anything. When they're going, gosh, Michelle Bachmann seems a little bit unstable. It's like, yeah, she's been elected three times. That's 6 years. Where have you been? Because I've been talking about her since 2004 on stage. You know, and so that kind of stuff makes you feel like, wow, it's crazy. And then the other part of the coin is, you know, when you elect a Democrat and people are like, don't. I get it from both sides. I get the conservatives, you know, lobbing on to me, you know, blah, 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 you're a socialist and whatever the hell I am. And then I get the Democrats lobbing on me when I'm like, I'm not particularly fond of our president dropping drone bombs on people who live in a country and they are unarmed. Or I'm not particularly fond of, you know, the carrying on, you know, unwarranted wiretaps and their stuff. I'm not psyched about Obama either. But I also, having said that, I'm not sure that when people say, well, I voted for Obama in 2008, now I'm going to vote for Romney. It's like, okay, you have no fiber. Like, who are you? How can you? There are two different people here. Like, yeah, Mitt Romney's going to make it all better because of the stuff you're bummed out about that Obama didn't give you in 2008, whatever that was, because Romney gave you Romney care. So right off the bat, that healthcare thing you're bummed out about, Romney invented it. So it's just like, I don't know anymore. It's really nuts trying to figure out what people know and when they don't know things, how hard they fight to the death to defend it. It's very interesting.
Perhaps we should end with all of his experience, both in media, in satire, in radio, and being a political observer as you are. Ideally now, what would you like to create that would have an impact and still allow you to use your creativity?
I think, you know, I turned 50 last year, and
you're not supposed to say that in Hollywood.
I know. I say it all the time. Bumps people out. I'm new in town. I'm new around these parts. I've still got all my old boobs and my old face and everything. I'm all me. But one thing that I have been doing that I've found incredibly enjoyable that I might try to pursue with some rigor is to develop an arm of political ads where I raise my own money and I tell the truth rather than having to have any party affiliation or anything to bring humor and use scathing sort of satire to hit messaging home in a way that really hasn't been done on the left before, with truth, with facts, with humor, but also that has a bit of edgy satire to it. And I've started doing it. In fact, I'm rolling one out in a couple of weeks that sort of takes on the issue of the war on women in a pretty profound way that involves a transvaginal ultrasound. So how do you make that funny? Well, listen up. Go to as4.org, which is an organization that I've started to help for raise awareness to women's health issues. So you can go there and the video will be there.
Liz Winstead, Liz Free or Die Essays. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
That's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to producers Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can get it from kpfk.org and click on the archives, or from armudian.com, scholarcircle.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at Armudian. Have a great day, and we'll see you next week.
Alone in a cold, cruel world.